From Studio H3 in the Current Affairs World Headquarters, it's Current Affairs, your ears' greatest hour of politics and culture. I'm Pete Davis, your host. To finish off the year, we have a very special episode. For the full episode, we present to you a conversation between Current Affairs Editor-in-Chief Nathan J. Robinson and The Intercept's Glenn Greenwald. But here's the twist. We're going to give Glenn a break from his usual MO of prosecuting crimes of the American Empire. Instead, we're going to ask him mostly about animals. Topics discussed include, how many dogs does Glenn own? What arguments do we have to make when begging a higher intelligence not to eat us? And yes, also, Glenn and Nathan couldn't resist talking about the crimes of the American Empire a bit before getting back to talking about dogs. Happy New Year, listeners. Here's Nathan and Glenn.
I'm here tonight with an incredibly special guest, a man who I've very much been looking forward to talking to. He is Mr. Glenn Greenwald, the founding editor of The Intercept, a Pulitzer and Polk Prize award-winning investigative journalist, the author of such books as No Place to Hide and With Liberty and Justice for Some, which is a perennially relevant book that explores the way that the rule of law is selectively applied to elites versus the rest of us. And most recently, he is the founder and proprietor of Homeless People and Animals Together, a shelter for dogs and homeless individuals in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Glenn, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. And I just want to underscore that of all of those qualifications, the one of which I'm most proud and I believe is most appropriate is that I am an extremely special guest. I just wanted to underscore that.
And you are also the subject of an amusingly hostile New Yorker profile, which is sort of how you know you've made it. So congratulations on that.
Well, you know, there's a backstory to that, which is the New Yorker contacted me in January and said they wanted to do a profile of me. And literally 2 or 3 days after that, the New York Magazine contacted me almost with a verbatim email and said essentially the same thing. And obviously, everybody just instinctively would want to be profiled by the New Yorker rather than New York, given how much bigger the New Yorker is and how much more prestigious it is in certain circles, the ones that I don't value, but many other people do. And I talked to both authors and decided that the person from New York Magazine, who was like this 27-year-old kid that nobody knew, was a much more interesting and wanted to do a much more serious profile than the very well-established, well-known, and extremely British, which I'm going to leave neutral given who the podcast host is and as an adjective, writer for The New Yorker. And so I told The New Yorker basically to fuck off, and I decided I was going to instead cooperate with New York Magazine, which did in fact do, although I could quibble with parts of it, like a very fair and good faith profile trying to understand my positioning in the Trump era, my views on Russia and the like. And then when The New Yorker called and they were so angry that I chose to go with New York Magazine, which in their eyes was like being interviewed by, you know, like the little corner, the guy on a cardboard box on the corner. They came back after the profile was out and said, you know, actually, we still want to do an interview, a profile of you. And I said, you know, that's really odd. Why would you want to do that? New York was really comprehensive. Mm-hmm. It was very viral.
Yeah, why?
And they said, well, we just think we can go much deeper. And I should have known
then. We have so much to say
because
about you.
I knew, yeah, there's so much like bullshit insults about you that they left out that we want to include. Yeah. And we want to do it in our like pseudo-intellectual, like very subtle way that you don't realize that like, you're being slimed until you get like 5 paragraphs after it. And so I really should have followed my instinct and again rejected them, but I didn't. And it was interesting because I made the decision that unlike prior profiles where I was going to try and manipulate the outcome, I just tried to do an experiment. I said, let me just be as open and honest as possible. And they just violated that in every way. So I was thinking about writing about it like once a year goes by, so it doesn't seem vindictive, but at the same time, I can actually show people how deceitful and manipulative and abusive these profiles are when they set out on purpose to try and do a hit job.
I nearly did a full dissection of it because I thought it was a really interesting example of how you can use access to make someone look as horrible as possible. They gave you what I think we would call the full Chomsky treatment. Full Chomsky treatment?
Full Chomsky. That is incomprehensible.
Take a poll among U.S. intellectuals.
Full Chomsky
support
treatment?
For bombing Afghanistan is just overwhelming. A
of them think that you should bomb Washington.
That is incomprehensible.
Which is moving in extremely ominous directions.
I say it's not necessary to pay attention because of efficient markets. I mean, is that very different from God Promised Noah?
Full Chomsky treatment?
That is incomprehensible.
They gave you what I think we would call the full Chomsky treatment, because it was very similar to a profile they wrre in, I think, 2002 of Noam Chomsky at the height of war fever.
Right, exactly. I wanted to go write an anatomy of it and kind of go, not paragraph by paragraph exactly, but just pick like the 35 most egregious examples where they so obviously and deliberately took all of my quotes out of context wildly in order to distort them and give them the least generous possible interpretation. But I couldn't do it right away because then I would look like I was just doing it out of like anger or grievance or whatever. When I really didn't care, all I wanted to do was just kind of dissect it, because I've noticed it since the Snowden stuff, and I've written about this before, you can be a media critic and be critically scrutinizing of journalism and see where they're being propagandistic and manipulative. But when you're the subject of news reports, you know firsthand a lot of times that they're just lying, and you know how they're lying. And so you can give particular insight into the tactics that bad faith, deceitful journalists use. So I felt like I could really do a journalistic service had I done it, but I just needed to wait a little bit of time. But yeah, maybe I'll leave that into your capable hands.
The problem is that if I dissect it, I'd have to read it again. And there are certain things where once is too many times. I'm so honored that I got the full barking in the background.
People actually complain at this point if I do an interview or podcast, even live TV, when my dogs are uncharacteristically quiet. They feel like they're being deprived of something to which they've come to expect an entitlement. So I'm also glad
that's what I say. It's a privilege, and especially because of the subject of today's podcast, which is animals. And you are known as a man of many dogs. If people know one thing about you, other than that you're a hysterical, paranoid conspiracist who won't accept the facts on Russia, they probably know that you have a lot of dogs. Right. How many is it now? I hesitate to ask.
Well, the number varies because we're self-delusional. So a lot of times we'll like pick up and bring to our house like a dog and then give it this like temporary guest status, which is just our psychological tactic for not accepting that we've done something incredibly stupid and picked up another dog. So right now we have 24 dogs plus what I would call two guest dogs. So the total is 26, but only 24 are officially residents.
Do you actually know... are you able to keep track of all the dogs' names?
It's funny that you say that, because I used to wonder that about like people who had like 12 or 14 children. Like, do they know the names of all their kids? And like, do they even recognize them? Like, once you get to so many, is it even possible to keep track? And I used to genuinely wonder that about people with like 12 kids. And now when people ask me, do you know the names of all 24 of your dogs? I get so offended. I'm like, how dare you? Of course I know. I have extremely personal relationships with each of them.
So 24 dogs, not too many dogs then.
It's funny because both my husband David and I talk all the time about how we should be more timid when people ask us how many dogs we have. Just like saying 24 as though it's a normal thing, because we forget that 99.9% of the people on the planet think that you ought to be institutionalized. Like, they think you're a hoarder or like one of those crazy cat ladies who gets caught with like 186 cats in her like 1.5 bedroom apartment, and the health department comes and like arrests her. They're all rescue dogs. We foster them. We've placed many dozens, probably hundreds, in homes. We purposely live in places in Rio where there's a lot of property for the dogs. So it's not like we're living in like a studio apartment with 24 dogs. I mean, we live in, you know, a place that on purpose has like a lot of outdoor space so that it can accommodate dogs.
I think that answer is not going to convince anyone that it's not insane to have 24 dogs, but do 24 dogs, do they kill it? I don't understand. Are there fights? I don't get how 24 dogs can inhabit a space together. I mean, I just watched that video that you did about your shelter, which I want to talk about, where you see the dogs actually get along, and they all did seem to be getting along, and it seems very strange because when you think of a bunch of animals together, you think that can't go well.
I mean, dogs are complicated social creatures, and it is really fascinating. I grew up with one dog and two dogs, and the kind of typical dog experience. So I didn't realize the complexity of their social behavior. One of the fascinating things is that cliques form within the dog packs, and they're extremely difficult to predict. Certain dogs hang out with other dogs as like their friends in certain places of the house or outside. The most seemingly disparate dogs end up as kind of subparts of the pack. And then there are two or three dogs that can't actually be near one another. They're dominant females and they will fight. So they kind of have to be let out of places in shifts. So there's some complexity to it, but by and large, they all know each other, and with very rare exception, they won't fight. Occasionally, a fight will break out, like with children, if they just are in a bad mood or whatever, and then you just pick them up and throw them in the pool, because that's the only way that you can separate dogs determined to kill each other. Other than that, it usually works out pretty smoothly.
Is there anything else that you have learned about dogs over the course of owning 24 plus two guest dogs? I guess owning is probably not... The dogs own themselves. Living with dogs as equals. Anything else about dogs that people don't know that is an insight that comes with this living situation?
I mean, I know this is going to sound a little bit trite and syrupy and Hallmarkish, but it really is true that, and this is the thing I try and emphasize so much, is a lot of times when people hear that you rescue dogs or people talk about adopting a dog, they almost talk about it like it's an act of charity, like you're doing something for a living being in need, and you are. But the reality is that each and every dog has an individual personality. They all have a kind of wisdom that human beings really don't naturally have. I mean, I know it sounds odd to people who don't have dogs because they think dogs are just of inferior intelligence. And of course, there are a lot of types of intelligence where humans are superior to dogs. But just like dogs have superior hearing and superior sense of smell by many magnitudes as compared to humans, there's also just things that they intuit and ways that they interpret the world that you can actually learn from them about how to just be in the present, about how to let past traumas go, about how to connect to people empathetically. You cannot trick a dog about your emotions. So if you fake cry, but you're really happy, they won't think you're sad. But if you're really sad and you try and hide it from them, they'll know that you're sad. They're extremely empathetic. They connect on a very emotional level because they've evolved to really receive and understand human emotions, which is why we call them man's best friend. So each and every dog does have an individualized wisdom that comes from whatever their experience is or breed is or just individuality is. And so every dog that we've picked up has given something to us as well.
I think this is something that probably a number of dog owners would be nodding with you there. People have had close relationships with dogs. You are someone who, I mean, you run a dog shelter and you have a lot of dogs. Animal rights and animal welfare issues more broadly have been interesting to you. You wrote a long piece fairly recently about pigs, actually, and made the case that these traits of emotional depth are not actually unique to man's best friend. They are widely present in the animal kingdom. And you wrote that pigs are, quote, among the planet's most intelligent, social, and emotionally complicated species, capable of joy, play, love, connection, suffering, and pain. And so I want to ask you about that, about your writing on pigs, and also about kind of where that takes you in terms of raising disturbing implications about a number of human practices, since a lot of people recognize that dogs are wonderful and they keep dogs as pets, but they slaughter pigs by the billion.
Well, that's right. And I mean, I have, you know, I consider myself fairly a newly arrived person to the movement of animal rights. And I've spent a long time thinking about why it took me so long to get there, because I've loved dogs my entire life. And yet I would support industries and consume the products of industries that would torture and slaughter, as you say, by the billions, pigs and cows and chicken and turkeys and the like, and goats. And so the question that I ultimately ended up having to confront was, why is it that if we see a dog being abused, do we feel so morally outraged to the point where we want that person to go to prison? And in fact, in all 50 states in the United States, they will go to prison if they inflict suffering and torture and gratuitous pain on an animal the same way they would a human. Whereas we are completely indifferent to similar types of suffering and torture and pain being gratuitously inflicted on the animals that serve as our food, like pigs and cows and goats and the like. And so for a while, you can tell yourself that there are moral distinctions between the animals you value and the animals that you don't, but none of them are sustainable upon any kind of minimal scrutiny. As you just said, if intellect is your moral metric, there are animals more intelligent by most metrics than dogs, including pigs, including fish, including large mammals. Why does the internet go crazy when it sees a lion or an orangutan or a leopard being killed in Africa while your outrage is bubbling over? You're shoving into your mouth the carcass of an animal at least as intelligent, if not more so, than the one you're so angry had just been killed. So none of it really makes moral sense. And ultimately what I realized is that the reason why we're able and willing to sustain this industrial, systemic, global torture and slaughter of animals is because we just turn away from it. We don't look at it. We don't watch it. Laws are erected to make sure we don't have to see it. It's exactly the same model for how we allow our government for 20 years now to go around bombing multiple Muslim countries, because we just don't need to know the victims' names. We don't learn about the aspirations that have been extinguished. We don't see their charred bodies. We just pretend that it's not happening. We only know in the abstract at most that it's happening, but we don't viscerally internalize it. And so the more I kind of, as a journalist, started digging into the realities of factory farming, the more I forced myself, I didn't even want to, the more I got forced to accept that these are moral atrocities on a massive scale, which cannot be tolerated if you're a person who likes certain kinds of animals. There's just no way any longer to distinguish it morally, ethically, politically, or in any other way and allow it to happen.
Let's go to break.
Hello again. This is Kara Battersby.
And I'm Jeff Honeysuckle.
And you're listening to Straight from the Horse's Mouth, only on NPR.
We have a very special show for you today. Some news from our stable, so to speak.
That's right, Jeff. In fact, if you talk to NPR's own temps and interns, they'll probably tell you they haven't been feeling stable at all.
Ha ha ha. Indeed, Kara. Indeed. In fact, we've had a bit of a, well, I wouldn't call it a riot, exactly.
Would it be more accurate to say an uprising?
An uprising, yes. That's le mot juste. You see, here at NPR, we rely on the continued support of listeners like you, and also a large contingent of underpaid interns and precariously employed temporary workers.
A veritable army of temps. Wouldn't you say so, Jeff?
I would say so. Well, that's the temps right now, beating on the glass. They've taken over 3 of the conference rooms and all the major hallways.
Sources from inside the temp workers' encampment tell us they'll continue to occupy the building until all their demands are met. These demands are fair pay, full employment, and regular scheduling.
On behalf of myself and my full-time colleagues, let me just say that we fully sympathize with our temp workers' demands to be treated like real human beings.
It's just that we can't precisely condone their approach. Jeff, you and I have been trapped in this recording booth for 3 days now?
That's right, Kara. That's right. We've been defecating in a corner.
It's been hell. If you sympathize with our plight and would like to support NPR during this difficult time, a pledge of just $5 a month goes an awfully long way. Just $5 a month, and listeners like you can keep NPR readily supplied with riot gear, tasers, body armor, and Xanax.
Pledge now, and we'll send you our Make Love, Not War tote bag. our Solidarity Forever keychain, and, for a limited time only, our Bread and Rosettes cake decorator.
Oh, how I'd love to bake a cake. Oh, we haven't eaten in 36 hours.
Ha ha, Kara. I think we may die in here.
Sources aren't sure who dug the pits outside the recording studio, or who filled them with sharp spears whittled from the office ficus plants. But one thing's for certain, we're definitely not getting out alive.
Pledge now, and I'll throw in a personalized I'm with the Temps lapel pin that I made personally out of my grandfather's cufflinks, a paperclip, and sheer desperation. Pledge now, pledge often. Call NPR's management and tell them...
This has been Straight from the Horse's Mouth, only on NPR.
There's a kind of bizarre thing that happens where almost the worse something is, the less likely we are to pay attention to it if the implications are too enormous to grasp. I wrote a piece a little while back that got some attention in the animal rights community called Meat and the H, where people try to be very careful, and I try to be very careful about invoking Holocaust comparisons, especially given the tendency to dehumanize people through comparing them to animals or what have you. But thinking about the way that extreme atrocities and extreme suffering is turned away from. And in some sense, if you confront the animal welfare issue head on, the implications really are very, very disturbing. I mean, when you look at the actual facts of what it is that is done every day, once you accept, and it seems to me like a very simple logic when you say, well, animals are sentient, animals suffer. I think Jeremy Bentham was the one that said, you know, the question is, can they suffer? They can suffer. We all know that they could suffer. All of the distinctions between animal species kind of break down, as you say. And once you accept that, then it really does seem as if we're complicit in something that is just, given the scale of factory farming, is just absolutely atrocious. And that's really hard to accept, in part because you don't want to think of people you love as being bad people. You don't want to think of yourself as being a bad person who is causing horrible pain and suffering. And in some ways, it doesn't seem like you're causing pain and suffering. It seems so normal to eat meat. There's a kind of cognitive dissonance that causes us to turn away. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even now that I'm doing a lot of activism and a lot of journalism in this field, every time I talk to the incredibly brave animal rights activists, you know, the people who go in the middle of the night into factory farms to film it so that we don't turn away any longer or even rescue symbolic animals from the billions that are about to go to the slaughterhouse who are on the verge of death, and then they take them to a veterinarian and save them and then get prosecuted under felony laws for doing so. I brace myself every time I'm interviewing one of them where I get to the point where they're about to describe to me what it is that they saw when they entered the slaughterhouses or the places where these animals are kept, for example, pigs in pens that are so tiny that they can never in their entire lives turn around. Literally, they just stay indoors. They never see the sun. They just keep forcing them to reproduce. They step on their own babies. They never turn around in their entire lives. The pens are so small, the pigs cannot move. And the only time they see the sun is when they just can't reproduce any longer. And they're finally taken to the slaughterhouse. So they're finally taken out of that one building in which they spend years of their lives reproducing. And then go to slaughter, and that's the one time. So when you hear that, when you hear about, you know, the injuries and the disease in which they're all wallowing, the emotional suffering, these pigs from isolation because they're social animals, just like humans, if you keep them in prolonged solitary confinement, will go insane. Most of them go insane. They start gnawing on their metal bars, desperately trying to get out until their teeth fall out while their gums are bleeding. Just things that are so horrific that even, as I said, now that I know about it, now that it's one of my primary causes, I still don't actually want to hear much about it. I often scroll fast past videos of it. So I do think it is all dependent upon just making sure that we don't become aware of the consequences of our actions. And that's why I say so many draconian laws have been put into place that actually characterizes animal rights activists as terrorists or prosecutes them under felony laws. They've gone to prison for years simply for exposing the realities of this industry we support, because this industry knows that human beings of good conscience won't continue to permit it to continue if we're actually aware of what it is that's being done. Let me just add one last point, which is this fascinating thing that I have noticed. You know, my husband and I adopted 2 children last year, 10 and 8, and they came out of a orphanage in northeastern Brazil, which is one of the poorest regions of the country, and they were malnourished, and the only thing they ate ever was meat with rice and beans. And because they were malnourished, we couldn't really change their diet quickly, and there was so much change with adoption anyway, so we didn't want to change their diet. But I wanted them to know what it was that they were consuming. I just wanted them to know what they were eating, even though I was going to leave it to them to make the decision. We would go to a farm and we would play with chickens or goats, and then they would, or a cow, we would see cows, and they would talk about how beautiful the cows were. And then when they would get meat on their plate or chicken on their plate, I would say, hey, remember those chickens we played with? That's what was killed to give you that food. And they were so angry at me, like I had done something, and they never want to hear it. And I always find that fascinating, because if it really is so natural for us to just slaughter animals with whom even children develop an emotional bond and connection, why are they so angry when I make them aware of what has been done to feed them? Why aren't they just indifferent to it the way you would if you said, hey, a plant was used and the fruits of it, of what it grows, was used in order to feed you? They would say, oh, that's beautiful, that's awesome. But if I say, hey, a cow was slaughtered in order to give you that slab of meat that used to be part of the cow, they get really upset and angry. Why is that if it's so natural?
It's bizarre. I've had people, you know, I've been a vegetarian for 10 years, and there is a certain aspect where people get very, very defensive, even if you just tell them you're vegetarian. You don't say it with any particular judgment, but because it gets people, I feel like it draws people closer to examining the truth. And so it's very, very uncomfortable. So we have defense mechanisms. You also wrote recently about this controversy with the Texas law about public officials have to swear that they won't boycott Israel. And I feel like there's a lot of examples of things where, because people in power or of interest to protect know that if people are allowed to confront the truth of the factual situation, they will be morally repelled. They are willing to violate pretty common basic values that we say we all hold. Like, oh, of course we believe in free speech. Of course we believe in your right to look at what you want and read what you want, and the free market. But because it's so threatening, because in certain situations speech is so threatening, all of those values go out the window, because it would take so little almost to turn public opinion against these kinds of atrocities.
I think it's a crucial point. You know, one of the reasons why I've devoted myself with such vehemence to defending free speech, first as a lawyer and now as a journalist, is because I do think that so much human evil depends upon manipulating other people's perceptions and concealing critical information about how the world really works. And censorship is one of the primary means to do that. There are others, like stigmatizing people who dissent from orthodoxies and the like. And before I started writing about animals, I spent most of my time as a journalist writing about the war on terror. And I remember I had this epiphany once. I was in Canada. You probably remember when the parliament was attacked. It ended up being attacked by somebody who was from a Muslim family, but had a long history of mental health struggles. And almost certainly the mental health struggles played a far greater role in the decision to attack the parliament than any religious or political convictions. But when it happened, of course, it was immediately, because he had an Arab name and was from a Muslim family, was depicted as a terror attack. And he killed one person. And this one person was like a 24-year-old security guard who worked in Ottawa in front of the parliament. And for a week when I was in Canada, it was nothing but profiles of his life, interviews with his grieving relatives, an examination of his childhood, of what he wanted to do. The prime minister went to his funeral. His name was just flooding everybody's brain because he was one of our victims. And it just, everybody was so angry at the idea of terrorism. And yet Canada was a country that had been at war for 16 years by that point, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya, and other places. And not only could no Canadians name a single victim of any of those wars, literally not one of them who had been killed by their own government, they barely even knew their government was at war. I kept hearing, why would anybody want to come and inflict any kind of violence in Canada. We're such a loving, peaceful nation. When in reality, they're flying fighter jets over multiple countries around the world and dropping bombs that are killing people. They just, it's so concealed from them, that reality, that they weren't lying. That is really the perception that they've been fed, because how else would they allow their government to continue to keep killing people around the world in a way that was compatible with how they want to think about themselves? And I think you're absolutely right that that's the same scheme that over and over and over and over is what enables and empowers evil acts to take place, just preventing people from knowing their reality.
I wrote an article about a while back examining the way that people defend the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because I was very interested in the arguments that are made. Because on the surface, some of the actual, the structure of the argument can be persuasive, and you can have the debate that says, okay, well, it was the least bad way to end the war. Now, you can dispute that on factual grounds, which I do. But what I was interested in these articles was the way that the people who made those arguments also would never, ever, ever discuss what it actually means to vaporize a city with an atomic weapon. So they would say, well, of course it was horrific. And they use the word horrific, and horrific would be all you needed to capture the reality. Yes, 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 it's horrific. Blitz past the acknowledgement of its horror, because if you say, well, yes, we incinerated thousands of children in front of their mother's eyes, then it becomes nearly impossible to make your utilitarian argument. And I see this when conservatives defend Churchill or when they defend Christopher Columbus, they'll go, well, of course they did some bad things. And some bad things will be the sum total of the criticism when you blitz past the some bad things. But if you actually examine it, if you say, well, Columbus cut out people's tongues, then it makes it really much more difficult to say, but on the whole, he was on the whole beneficial. So you kind of have to downplay and avoid confronting the human reality if you're going to sustain certain arguments where the arguments on the surface kind of look like they work, but they only work because you've blotted out so many actual implications of it.
Yeah, I think we see actually promising changes in a lot of different realms as a result of internet technology, because if you look at how people talked about the internet when it first started proliferating and becoming widely used, there were a lot of very utopian promises made about what its effects would be, some of which have been fulfilled, others of which have most decidedly not been. But one of the things that I think has actually transformed the way that we live as a world is that it has changed the way information gets disseminated, because of the ease with which people can now film and disseminate the reality of what's taking place. I think one of the most important and blatant examples is how worldwide people think now so much differently about the Israel-Palestine conflict, because instead of just allowing two or three pro-Israel reporters into Gaza or the West Bank, everybody who lives there now has a cell phone and internet access and a Twitter and Facebook account and can upload the families who are dead as a result of Israeli bombs, or there's lots of people who have access to cameras who can film kids on beaches being shot by Israeli fighter jets recklessly or indiscriminately, or snipers and the like. And it's really radically changed how people perceive of Israel, from the plucky little democracy that occasionally and accidentally, very unwittingly, kills innocent people, to this just reckless occupier that has no regard for Palestinian life, that treats them essentially like rats are treated, easily extinguishable and the like. And so it's really shifted how the world thinks about this issue for no reason other than the fact that we've changed the information that is now available about it. And I really do believe that the cause of the next generation, or one of the causes of the next generation, is going to be confronting the ethical horrors of the agricultural industry and the way in which our food supply depends upon the infliction of extreme levels of gruesome torture on living beings that are, as you said, sentient and capable of suffering and do suffer and feel love and feel loss and feel hurt. It's just morally unsustainable if we end up having to confront the reality of it. And all of this technology is making us now confront it. And I think you're going to see that in more and more areas.
It's a really interesting point, because I have noticed an odd shift, because I mean, I was in high school at the height of war fever in 2003 to 2007. And it was bizarre how everyone who opposed the war was considered essentially a traitor to the United States. And there has been a huge, huge shift. I mean, now the Senate resolution on Yemen was completely unprecedented. You notice that there's almost a bipartisan anti-war consensus where Donald Trump ran against the Iraq war as part of one of the things he used against Hillary Clinton. The Weekly Standard just collapsed because the pro-war conservatives have just disappeared. It does seem like there's part of it that is just like people have finally managed to confront a reality that was obscured in the post 9/11 era. And the positions that Noam Chomsky was on the fringe for all of his life have somehow almost become consensus. And that's kind of an encouraging development. One other thing is that I was thinking about when you mentioned... I was thinking about when we were talking about this. I read... The Guardian published the letter that Osama bin Laden published to America after 9/11, where he talks about his motives. And you've written a lot about how if you actually listen to people's motives, they're often not what is presented in the press if you confront the facts. The first things that Osama bin Laden talks about, he says, you ask us why we attack you, it's because you attacked us. And he goes through a list of things the United States has done. And it's again weird because... if you were going to make the case fairly, you would disagree very strongly with his justification, obviously, and the consequences of his and what he's arguing for, which is the legitimacy of attacking U.S. civilians. But you would at least be able to acknowledge the facts. And Chomsky spent his whole life trying to remind people over and over again of things that the United States has done, but feels the need to forget in order to maintain the illusion that its national interest is a good thing. I just covered all the coverage about George H.W. Bush's death, where the only way that you could portray him as a dignified, as a good man, is to ignore the fact that he imprisoned Haitian refugees at Guantanamo, to ignore the fact that he said that he'll never apologize for America after we blew an Iranian civilian airliner out of the air and killed nearly 300 people. Things that just, if you so much as look at them, instantly destroy the prevailing narrative.
That bin Laden letter is probably the best example of the censorship utility I was describing earlier and has been forgotten, even though it's one of the most stunning cases of corporate media censorship. Maybe in U.S. history, people forget that after 9/11, when the World Trade Center collapsed and a plane was flown into the Pentagon, obviously traumatic and genuinely terrorizing events. I lived in Manhattan on the day of 9/11, and I remember imprinted into my memory forever the trauma and terror of what that was like. People very legitimately wanted to know, why would someone want to do this to us? Why? That was really the, after kind of the shock of the first week of just processing the event, that was really the question that everybody had. And the answer was readily available in the mouths of the people who did it. And the reason that that wasn't sufficient was because no Americans heard it. And the reason no Americans heard it, you mentioned that it was published in The Guardian, which especially in 2002 or 2001 was read almost exclusively by subjects of the United Kingdom and almost never by any American citizens because the internet wasn't very prevalent. People forget that the United States government instructed the major television networks and cable networks not to broadcast any explanations from Osama bin Laden about why he did what he did, including interviews that he conducted with Al Jazeera or other videotapes that he made that were intended to explain why he believed the 9/11 attacks were justified, by claiming that, and this is so unbelievable that the networks obeyed this, they claimed that there would be secret signals embedded in this videotape that would activate sleeper cells in the United States to attack again. Like he would blink in Morse code or use his eyebrows in a certain manner of movement that would in advance have been a signal to the sleeper cells that it was time to attack again. They just invented this fantasy that wouldn't even make it into a James Bond film about how villains function to give censorship orders to all of the television networks, which they obeyed on the grounds of national security. So no one got to hear from Al-Qaeda what their answer was about why did we attack. They didn't get to hear, we attacked because you killed 500,000 Iraqis as part of your sanctions regime during the Clinton years, including tons of Muslim children, or that you are helping Israel occupy Palestinians, or you have your military bases on our sacred land in Saudi Arabia, or have been killing people in the Muslim world and propping up dictators in the Muslim world for your own benefit and treating our land as your private oil fields for decades. You can agree with that. You can not agree with it. Obviously, in my view, at least, it doesn't justify killing 3,000 people. But if you want to know the reasons, their reasons, what's going on in their head, you would necessarily want to listen to that. And yet, instead, they censored that, blocked it, never quoted it, and instead had David Frum and Ari Fleischer and Donald Rumsfeld invent this storyline that the real answer to the question, why do they hate us, why would they want to do it, is they hate us for our freedoms. Because we allow gay people to walk on the street and not be murdered, because women get to wear skirts and go to work. They hate our freedoms. You know, this fairy tale. And it, the only reason why that worked is the same thing we've been talking about in every other instance, because information was sufficiently controlled that people didn't know actual reality and therefore really had no alternative but to believe it.
Yeah, and of course, when you turn it into something like that, if it's a hatred for our freedoms, and if it's a kind of irrational attack, if there aren't explanations for it, it does make people just so much more terrified and so much more willing to lash out, and because it does seem then like a battle for the soul of civilization, it does seem like a battle that can, you know, we'll never be able to live in peace until we destroy radical Islam, because clearly it is just an unthinking lashing out, and it's either them or us.
Well, and let me just interject there too, because a lot of people have forgotten the history of this. And I mean, I having lived through it and then having gone back as a journalist and written a lot about it, it is really amazing and important to recall. After the 9/11 attacks, maybe 6 or 8 weeks after the 9/11 attacks, something much scarier in the US happened than the 9/11 attacks, which was the anthrax mailing attacks. Because the 9/11 attacks were aimed at the centers of power in Manhattan and Washington. So if you lived in Texas or Florida or Idaho or Oregon, you could kind of feel like it was kind of kept at a distance. Not that it wasn't terrifying, but you didn't feel directly threatened. But anthrax showing up in your mailbox, that's genuinely terrifying. That's just everyday people who are now having chemical weapons sent through the U.S. Postal Service. It can be randomly kill people. It can kill anybody. And that's what really gave this feeling like the entire social order was starting to unravel. And ABC News went and did a report in which they said, Brian Ross reported, and it went all over ABC News, Good Morning America, ABC with Peter Jennings, that government tests had proven the existence, the presence in the anthrax of the substance bentonite, which is just a very common chemical used in laundry detergents and the like, that they claim was the hallmark of Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons program. So right after 9/11, you then had the major media and the U.S. government anonymously lying and blaming Iraq, which in the minds of Americans is also Arab and Muslim, and it's just kind of all mixed in, now attacking them through the mailbox. And that obviously laid the foundation for the Iraq War. By September of 2003, 6 months after the invasion, 70% of Americans believed a total lie, which was that Saddam Hussein personally participated in the 9/11 attacks. To this very day, we don't know who fed the government, the media, those lies about the presence of bentonite and Saddam being responsible. And also what we do know, according to the U.S. government's own case, is that in fact, the anthrax attacks came from the U.S. Army. It was a scientist who worked for the U.S. Army, they claim, that was actually responsible for sending those anthrax attacks, which became fundamental to the next 18 years of the eternal war on terror. So just think about how deceit, misinformation, and active censorship played a crucial role in determining how Americans thought about the most important issues that they would face for the next 2 or 3 decades, notwithstanding the fact that they believe they have a free press and a free flow of information, and that propaganda is stuff that only happens in Iran, North Korea, and China, and Russia.
I do want to get back to animals soon, but this is so interesting because it also makes me think about another theme that you've written about a lot, which is the fact that there's also a complete lack of accountability after the fact and a burying of responsibility. Your book, With Justice for Some, is about this a lot. Now you have a lot of the worst people of the Bush administration rebranding themselves as resistance heroes, as you see, without any accountability for their role in this sort of murderous lie that caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. We just got a review copy of one of Charles Krauthammer's books, his collection of his columns. The late Fox News contributor Charles
Krauthammer. I hope you're not going to say anything critical about Charles Krauthammer, because as you know, he is deceased and we have an absolute bar against speaking critically of the dead.
I am just going to make one observation, which
I hope it's very neutral and respectful.
Completely respectful observation, which is that in his best-selling collection, his book of columns, it interestingly... He has a part about Iraq from right after 9/11, and then he has a part about Iraq from about 2008 where he's talking about why the surge was great. And the book of his best of columns skips the years from 2002 to 2008, in which you would have found Charles Krauthammer writing columns like The Three-Week War, in which he claimed that there has never been an occupation before that has managed to preserve the country while overthrowing its leaders. But this three-week war has shown that the United States knows how to preserve a country when it invades and occupies it. All of the sort of really, first off, hideously embarrassing, but also complicit in a horrendous crime, all of these pieces just sort of written out of the record so that nobody's ever held accountable, and then they get all these glowing eulogies as we got after George H.W. Bush.
I think my favorite Charles Krauthammer passage is where he wrote in, I think it was July or August of 2003, maybe 4 or 5 months after the invasion, when it started to become a serious possibility that there were in fact no weapons of mass destruction, the entire justification for the war that he supported. And that possibility was starting to really dawn on everybody, and people started thinking about what the implications were if the United States government spent the prior 18 months running around insulting everybody in the world against the war on the grounds that Saddam had nuclear and chemical and biological weapons that in fact just didn't exist, and we had just started a war over things that were the byproduct of nothing more than fantasy and hallucination. And he wrote this paragraph saying, essentially, we have 3 more months, and if we don't find weapons of mass destruction, those of us who said that they were there and that advocated for this war are going to have a serious and enduring credibility crisis.
Yeah.
And of course, 3 months later, they were never found, but he never went back and reviewed or accounted for that paragraph in any way. He never stood up and said, hey, by the way, my credibility has been obliterated by the fact that the weapons I told you were there and that you were an idiot for believing might not be there are in fact not there. It just, as you said, kind of got whitewashed. And there were just many, many, many people. In fact, I would say the vast majority of the most respected people in our political and pundit class who have very similar records as Charles Krauthammer, where you can go and find very similar passages.
Let's go to break. Hello, listeners. Just popping in to give you a reminder that we are having a live show on January 26th in Washington, D.C. at the Rock and Roll Hotel. Current Affairs Live is happening later this January, January 26th, in the nation's capital at the Rock and Roll Hotel. Get your tickets now. They are almost sold out. Just head over to an internet search engine, type in Current Affairs Live Show, Rock and Roll Hotel, January 26th, or some other string of similar words, and out will come a link to the tickets at the Rock and Roll Hotel for the Current Affairs Live Show. You don't want to miss this. The entire Current Affairs crew will be there. Brianna, Bree, Lyta, Oren, Sparky, me, Vanessa, and Nathan J. Robinson himself, all at the Rock and Roll Hotel, January 26th, sharing the full Current Affairs experience in person. Get your tickets now before they sell out. Let's get back to Glenn Greenwald.
I mentioned that you are a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, but you have nothing on New York Times correspondent Thomas L. Friedman, who I believe has won 3 of them for his commentary. And if you go back and look at the Friedman columns, they are essentially borderline genocidal. He has that famous interview where he says we need to go door to door in Iraq and tell the Iraqi people to suck on this. just, to me, like, psychotic and unhinged. I mean, he's mocked for his, like, I think the Freedman unit of, like, we're going to turn the corner into the next 6 months. They're going to be pivotal in Iraq. But the fact that he is a fated and celebrated journalist, still a commentator, still has his New York Times column, and you know, essentially, like, suck on this sounds like an invitation to wanton murder to me.
So I apologize to the audience. I didn't hear a lot of that question because I was starting a bonfire where I just threw my Pulitzer certificate into it after you mentioned
I'm
that
sorry
Tom
to
Friedman
devalue
three,
your,
so.
Your accolades from this.
You didn't just devalue it, you vandalized it and made it shameful. Yeah, you know, I think that one of the realities of American journalism and politics is that the more wars you support, there's just a direct relationship between your willingness to support war and how respected you are. And conversely, the more you oppose war, the less respected you are or the more stigmatized that you are. So if you look at all the people who are now the most beloved Russian hawks from like the people at the Brookings Institution, like Ben Wittes and the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, just all the people who have risen to the top of their profession and who are the most widely respected by the mainstream class of liberals and conservatives, they're basically the people who have devoted their adult lives to advocating for war. And then you look at the people who have been consistently anti-war and you find them in stigmatized and ostracized precincts like Noam Chomsky, like you mentioned earlier. It's really a direct relationship.
I do want to get back to the animal welfare issue, though. I think this is so important, and as we've discussed, so easy to turn away from. One of the things that always strikes me is how almost people who I really respect, when it comes to this issue, their arguments almost seem flimsier than they are on a lot of other things. Chomsky's an example who's like tries to avoid the animal issue, even though, you know, very smart and penetrating guy. I was looking up in preparation for this because I wanted to challenge you. I was trying to look up arguments against animal rights. And honestly, they're really hard to come by. All of the ones that you can come by are really quite flimsy. They say, well, morality is a concept that applies only to humans. Rights are a concept that should apply only to humans. But it's argument by assertion.
It's classic question begging, right? I mean, not question begging in the colloquial sense where everything gets called question begging, but actual question begging. So the question is, why is the life of humans worth preserving, but the life of animals are so worthless that we can just freely extinguish them and on the way inflict pain on them? And then the answer becomes humans are meant to live and thrive where it's permissible to kill animals. So the question is answered only by begging the question. That's the classic example of it. I think that for a long time, one of the arguments has been intellect. And I think it's very morally troublesome to start determining how much you believe life ought to be valued based on intellect. That, for among other things, has led to eugenic theories in the past where people of a certain IQ were deemed dispensable. Hitler famously and notoriously wanted to kill off people he regarded as idiots by using IQ tests that a lot of Nazi scientists were developing. We don't generally think that people who are more intelligent have more moral worth or inherent worth than people who are less intelligent. And again, then you look at how we treat dogs versus how we treat more intelligent species, or at least species as intelligent, such as pigs, and the distinction breaks down even further. And then there's a really interesting question, which is when we finally do get to the point, which is rapidly approaching, where we do have some form of artificial intelligence that on some level is autonomous, which definitely will be more intelligent by every metric than the standard human brain. Even the best human brain, the best functioning human brain, what arguments would we have as to why whatever we want to call that superior intelligence, shouldn't essentially use us for whatever it decides benefits it? What moral strictures do we have to justify why our lives ought to be preserved if intelligence is the metric?
I always think, what argument will I make when the aliens ask me why they shouldn't eat me? And
right.
I want to have a good response.
I'm sorry to say, Nathan, I don't think there is one. It's interesting because the only morally legitimate answer that you would give is you could say, because all life is valuable, even life forms that are less intelligent, and I have lived my life in accordance with that principle,
right,
by ensuring that I never contribute to the extinguishing of life that I regard as inferior. by not consuming them unnecessarily as food.
And they'll say, well, I don't share that belief, and into the pot.
Or they may say, I also have read Noam Chomsky and agree with your moral proposition that we ought to treat others the way we want to be treated and use that as our moral guide, as the Bible taught.
Sure.
And I therefore find your argument compelling. It all depends on whether they've read Chomsky and where they fit on the moral and ideological scale.
I'll make sure to have a copy of Understanding Power ready to hand the... And the invaders. It is striking to me, though, that people, I keep dwelling on, because I think a lot about how do you persuade people. I think a lot about persuasive writing, because I don't write, I write a left-wing magazine, but I try and target it at people who don't necessarily agree with me. You know, when I write about Jordan Peterson, I want to convince the people who like Jordan Peterson, not the people who already don't. And it is striking to me, I mean, I'm trying to find ways to get over this barrier. And the barrier is so strong that even people that I like have become the people that I think you've mentioned to me are the people you hate most in the world, most want to strangle, which is people who, when you talk about the morality of meat consumption, reply, but bacon is so delicious. I think you've told me that's...
The ones I hate the most are actually the ones who use the multiple M's to signify the sound that they make as they consume the bacon. Those are actually the ones at the very peak of my hierarchy of hatred. But, you know, I think that the whole question of communication is a really important one. And there's a division now in animal rights, a really fascinating debate, because there is a question of what is the ultimate principle that animates this movement. Is it simply one of incrementalism, where we want to encourage massive factory farming corporations like Smithfield to make the experience of being slaughtered for food a little less torturous and a little more pleasant? For example, by committing by 2020 to never to use the pens that I was talking about earlier that prevent the pigs from turning around, but instead give them a little bit more space before they're let out to slaughter, which has caused some animal rights groups to actually give Smithfield awards and to publicly praise them, even though they're continuing to slaughter animals by the billions. Or is it a kind of broader and more holistic philosophy that opposes what, for a lack of a better term, you would call speciesism? Just the idea that there is no moral right that humans have to use animals for their own pleasure or benefit by exploiting them, causing them pain and suffering, or killing them. Then there's an argument about, well, what's an effective tactic? Isn't that kind of too big of an ask to say we should just treat animal life as on par with human life? Or do you need a kind of animating moral principle in order for the whole movement to make sense, so that even, say, if it's a civil rights movement, you have this animating principle that the races are equal, even though you know that's too big of an ask and you're not going to get there for a couple hundred years. In the meantime, you work on incremental changes. So there is a debate taking place within the community of animal rights activists themselves about how best to communicate. When I wrote that article that you referenced earlier, the Smithfield article, I didn't know what to expect. That was the first time I had written about animal rights in that way. And it actually turned out to be one of the most read articles in the history of The Intercept, even to date. If you were to say to me, like, what are your five most influential articles that you've ever written in your career as a journalist, I would, without question, put that one in the top five. I've had so many different animal rights groups tell me what a game changer that article was. And I don't, I mean, I say that and I know it sounds like I'm kind of boasting of its significance, but I'm just trying to give insight into what I learned from it in terms of how best to communicate, because I spent a lot of time wondering why that resonated so much in that way. Part of it was, it just usually animal rights is talked about in that way only in animal rights and vegan precincts. So people who are already converted, whereas my audience was my audience. A lot of them never even thought about animal rights before they kind of got lured in, almost like bait and switch, like, hey, I'm going to give you 10 years of civil liberties, and now that you're paying such close attention, I'm going to like make you look at what's happening to pigs in Smithfield factories. What I did was I just tried to use very plain language. Because I'm so new to it myself, I'm not drenched in the jargon of animal rights activism. I don't have assumptions about what other people know. I really tried to start from the basics. Like, this is what a pig is. And this is what's done to them. And here's some video for you to take a look at. And it was just very shocking to be able to, because it was so stripped down and so plain. And I tried very hard not to, as you said earlier, alienate people through a kind of implicit moral denunciation. What I really tried to do, and I to this day do it, even though I am now fully vegan, is I emphasize to people that I didn't just overnight become vegan. It was a very incremental process. I first gave up pork, then I gave up meat, then I gave up chicken, then I gave up fish, then I gave up dairy. So I really encourage people, even if, you know, like nobody needs to eat pork. Like that's such an easy thing to eliminate from your diet, right? Like you just don't eat, you know, hot dogs or bacon or whatever has pork in it. It's such an easy thing to do, but an important thing to do. And you can just start thinking ethically about your own consumption choices that way.
I found the same thing when I wrote my big article on animal welfare. The responses that I got were surprising because I thought that I was going to get, especially because, as I say, I mean, I was explicitly drawing a comparison between how people turned away from the horrors of the Holocaust and how people today turn away from the horrors of animal suffering. That's just extremely controversial, and I thought I would get a lot of angry letters. I got hardly any. I got a few people saying, I think this was an alienating way to put this. I don't think you should have phrased it that way. But I didn't really get the angry responses I found. And I found that a lot of people, it is something that they kind of know. And it's an I know it, but I can't confront it. And if you give them a way to confront it that doesn't just make them feel guilty, I think a lot about how to prevent things in ways that don't just cause people to be miserable about their role in an atrocity, but that are constructive. And this is why there's a new book called The End of Animal Farming that I just reviewed that I really like because it has a positive vision and it says we can actually end this. And I think that's really helpful because if you present people with that, then they're more likely to. This is, I think, one of the reasons that climate change is avoided a lot, because if everyone just thinks the apocalypse is coming, then they don't want to think about it. It's just depressing.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain evils that are too overwhelming or certain scenarios that are too apocalyptic for, I think, our brains to comfortably process, and we instinctively turn away from them. This is a story that illuminated this, what I think is part of our human nature. There was kind of a small incident, but illuminating for me about this part of our instinct. I was in a cab about 7 or 8 years ago in Rio de Janeiro, and there was a light. We were approaching an intersection and it was green. And so the cab driver started accelerating in order to get through the green light and not have it turn yellow and then red and make him stop. And right as he was approaching the intersection, even though the light was still green, this elderly woman walked in front into the intersection right in front of the cab. And my brain quickly calculated that the speed he was going at and the distance that she was at made it inevitable that he was about to hit her in less than a second. I had no time to say anything. It was just an instinct that I shut my eyes. My eyes just closed. I did not want to see this inevitable horror that I was about to take place in front of me. So my eyes closed so that I didn't have to watch it. The cab did end up hitting her. It didn't kill her. It didn't even seriously injure her. Just kind of like, she just kind of went flying. She was like the most durable 75-year-old woman ever and like scraped her knee and like sprained her ankle. So it was a fairly happy ending. And afterwards I felt guilty. I said, is there something defective about me that my instinct wasn't to intervene to stop it. It was just to avoid being aware of it and having to see it in its most gruesome and graphic way. And I came to realize that, no, when we feel like something is inevitable and when we feel like we're impotent to stop it, it makes psychological and moral sense to turn away. And I think that's what happens with war. I think that's what happens with mass incarceration. I absolutely think that's what's happening with the moral atrocities of factory farms. It just feels too large scale and entrenched and inevitable for us to do anything as individuals about it. And therefore, it just makes sense to preserve our own sanity for us to shut our eyes to it and turn away from it and pretend it doesn't exist.
Yeah, so when you talk about what we can do as individuals, I just want to close here by talking about one thing that you are, in fact, doing on animal welfare. You have recently founded a shelter for dogs and your shelter, Homeless People and Animals Together. What are you doing? How is it working? Do you feel like you've pioneered kind of an interesting model there?
This is Chomsky's argument that you alluded to about why he continues to shove meat down his throat, even knowing the moral atrocities he's enabling, not just to animals, but also to the environment, which he classifies as the number one threat to humanity alongside nuclear war. Is if you ask him, well, why then do you continue to still eat meat? He'll say, because individual action doesn't really make a difference collective action is the only thing that can change these things. He also has an argument about why if you buy vegan food, trucks travel further across the country and burn more fuel, so it's a trade-off anyway. Whatever, I'll leave that to Chomsky's conscience, whether or not that's really true. But he does have this argument about individual versus collective action. And so, you know, when you start a shelter, and it all, the genesis of it is that we were working with the homeless population that lived on the street with their animals and started realizing that the bond between them is actually way more deep and profound. It's way deeper and more profound than the standard human-animal bond, as deep and profound as that is, where humans have other sources of fulfillment and happiness because they don't depend quite as much on the dog. And same for the dog. If the dog has lots of people around and kids and toys and other dogs, they don't need the human as much. But a human who lives on the street with his or her homeless animal, they basically are the only thing they have in the world. And so the bond becomes even stronger and more inspirational and more steeped in love and mutual dependence and connection. And so I thought about how could we tap into that? And we first did a couple of films that were produced by Laura Poitras, profiling a couple of those cases, and then decided to build a shelter based on that model that was designed not only to rescue and then place for adoption as many abandoned animals as we can, but to employ homeless people who have already demonstrated an affinity for animals so that we can teach them how to, you know, we work with social workers who specialize in homelessness. They teach them how to manage income, how to open a bank account, and eventually how to find an apartment and then get permanent employment, basically to reintegrate them into society. And we know that, you know, if we're helping 200 dogs and 15 homeless people every 6 months in the scope of the world where millions of dogs are euthanized every day and millions of human beings are living on the street, that as individual cases, it's still a moral good every time you decrease suffering and increase fulfillment of living beings. But in the scope of the problem, we know that it doesn't do very much quantitatively. So the idea is, yeah, to use my platform, my husband's platform, encourage other people to use theirs as you're doing, to shine a light on the capacity of this model to tap into this unique synergy and inspire other models around the world, to encourage people who have a lot of money to fund models like this. Because I do think that one of the interesting things is that when you work with animals, it's true that you're not really just helping the animals, you're increasing human beings' capacity for empathy, for compassion, for connection. A lot of human beings, a lot of us have trouble psychologically opening ourselves up emotionally to other human beings, whereas we're willing to with animals. That's why dogs are incredibly useful therapy tools for autistic children, for people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Animals can really open up this whole vista of emotional awakening and spirituality and compassion. And I see that obviously each dog that we help is really fulfilling. It's important unto itself. But I do see the model and the attempt to inspire other people to do similar things, or even things based on the same principles that are different in other fields, as the ultimate goal.
Well, it's a really exciting project, and people can support it on GoFundMe. We'll put a link in the show notes. And am I right that you're hoping to expand to rescue other animals, other types, species of animals at the shelter too in the future?
Yeah, actually, we just got a grant that is helpful in that way, and we're going to use it to get our first pigs. There's actually, in Rio, they use horses for work, and then when the horses reach an age where they can no longer work, they just kill them, but they're willing to give them to people to just let the horses graze for the last few years of their lives and have some fulfillment. So yeah, we're definitely going to have goats and other things like that.
Well, it's really exciting, and people can help on GoFundMe. So thank you so much, Glenn Greenwald, for joining me here on the Current Affairs Podcast.
Great talking to you, Nathan. Thank you for finally inviting me on to the podcast. I'm a little bit hurt and offended that it took this long, but I'm so glad the invitation that I've been waiting for so long finally arrived.
All right. Well, good luck to you. We'd have you back anytime. And
All right.
I'll see you. Good night.
Let's do footnotes. The amount of dogs you can own in one house is usually regulated at the city level through zoning codes. However, according to American City and County Magazine, there is a push by certain animal interest groups to dissuade cities from adopting pet limits and focus more on pet nuisance control. The aptly named Norma Wolf, Ohio Valley Dog Owners president, told the magazine, quote, "One dog that is irresponsibly owned can be a greater nuisance than five or six dogs who are properly cared for." The utilitarian philosopher Jeremy Bentham is a hero of animal rights advocates for this famous quote in his Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation. Quote, "The question is not can they reason, nor can they talk, but can they suffer?" Unquote. Over the course of the 12-year war, Canada deployed 40,000 military personnel to Afghanistan. The official term for an animal that receives more empathy from humans than other animals, and thus are useful in environmental campaigns, is charismatic megafauna. Examples of charismatic megafauna include the bald eagle, the humpback whale, the penguin, and the panda. Many thanks to Lyta Gold for our delightful bits. You can find her on Twitter at Fluttersnipe. Many thanks to you, the listeners, for sticking with us. It's people like you, and frankly, especially people like you, who become patrons at our Patreon page at patreon.com/currentaffairs that make this show happen. Thank you so much. This episode was edited by Dan Thorne at Pink Noise Studios in Somerville, Massachusetts. You can call in anytime at 504-867-8851 or email in at editor@currentaffairs.org. We might read your email or play your call on the air. Our theme song is The Gherkin Train by Joe Smith and the Spicy Pickles. Happy New Year. This has been Current Affairs.